This episode of the Season podcast was recorded by Dr. Ole Rummel and Mark McKenzie of the Season Center. You can listen to our other episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and as well as anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Season Center podcast. A lot has happened since our last podcast. We have had the dramatic failure of Silicon Valley Bank in the U.S., a bank that many of us knew very little about. So we have decided today to, my colleague and I, Dr. Ole Rummel, have decided to chat about it for a bit. My name is Mark McKenzie. I'm a senior financial sector specialist in the financial stability and supervision and payments work stream at the CSAT Center.
Thank you, Mark, and welcome and hello to everyone. As Mark said, my name is Ole, and we're looking forward to taking you through some of the more interesting facts and figures about Silicon Valley Bank, the causes of the failure, implications for the financial system, not only in the US, but also for some of our members, and some other points that we at least find interesting and would like to mention in the current context.
Exactly. I have been thinking about this since Saturday morning over breakfast when my wife said, "Have you heard a bank has failed?" I mean, how many of us before this past weekend knew that there was a bank called Silicon Valley Bank and that it was the 16th largest bank in the US? I mean, that's remarkable that this is how we learn about it.
Well, not only that, Mark, but I think there was a presumption amongst many of us that after the financial reforms of the 2008-2009 crisis, a bank run would be a thing of the past, or indeed a bank failure would be a thing of the past, because there have been many regulatory efforts, primarily, for example, the Dodd-Frank Act in the US, and we may come back to Barney Frank in a minute because he was involved in one of the banks as one of the directors of one of the failed banks. So here we have one of the architects of the US regulatory framework being caught up in his own bank. So the idea that in 2023 a bank could fail, especially in the technology sector, which has the reputation of being the place where the smartest people go, the most sophisticated investors. We have a lot of, we'll talk about this obviously in a minute, but we have a lot of very smart money putting their money or investing their money or depositing their money in Silicon Valley Bank. How this can happen is obviously something that is worthy of note, and we will talk about this.
So let's just take a step back in terms and just, you know, recollect ourselves in terms of what transpired over the last couple of days. I mean, honestly, before Saturday, I knew very little about this bank, but from what I have gathered is that around last Wednesday, the 8th of March, the bank announced that, well, it was have losing deposits and it was trying to raise capital, and it wasn't going very well. So that news was taken very poorly by the market, it seems, and a run started on the bank on Thursday and Friday. And by Thursday, about 60% of the bank share capital was lost. And about on Friday, another 60%. And by then, the California State Bank regulator took the bank over and appointed the U.S. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation to manage the bank. Now, if you don't know what the U.S. FDIC is, they essentially insure deposits of about $250,000 within the banking system in the U.S. And deposits over that amount is typically uninsured deposit. From what I've gathered from just our research over the last couple of days is that there are a significant amount of uninsured deposits in the US banking system. So the question is, if this one bank encountered such a dramatic run in two or three short days, would other banks within the US banking system be susceptible to such a run? And this is something that we should also explore as well, Ale.
We should also add to this that even though it was only the 16th largest bank in the US, it wasn't untypical for many of the small and mid-sized banks, which tend to focus on niche businesses and can be much more vulnerable to bank runs than larger peers, which are much more diversified and more protected against the bank runs. And what we saw, interestingly enough, was the typical example of the Diamond and Dybvig bank run.
Please continue, Alex.
But there were sort of some additional issues that we will also discuss in terms of the depositor base, the flow of information, the role of some big investors and their tweets, the role of social media in all of this. But let's go back to the basics. And as Mark said, around 95% of Silicon Valley Bank's deposits were uninsured. The average number for the major US banks is about one third. Yes. So three times the amount of deposits were uninsured than is customarily the case for US banks.
Let's talk a little bit about the insured deposits, Ale, because I think this is a big part of it. You mentioned earlier this whole issue of niche and concentration. So this bank in particular, its business model is in question because its business was predicated on the notion that it's provides services, banking services to startup tech firms, life cycle type firms in Silicon Valley. Some of these newer firms typically don't have cash flow, so they rely on private equity funds, VC funding, and they burn through cash very, very quickly. Additionally, in terms of concentration, on the asset side of the bank, it held significant portion of its deposits were invested in long-term government securities. The business of banking, Ole, is you borrow short, you invest long. But it also entails enormous risk management because there is a significant gap can occur if there are changes in the market environment. And this is one of the things that happened. But I mentioned the deposits because within the US banking system, I've learned that there are 92 trillion deposits across the banking system that exceed federally deposit insurance limits. So that is significant to some of the measures that we've seen in terms of response to Silicon Valley Bank so far.
Can I just add to this that the reason we have this limit of $250,000 that you mentioned is to encourage depositors to, if you have a wealth or money to invest above that amount, not to put it into the same bank, but to diversify it across banks such that you invest your money in such a way that all of your money is insured by the FDIC. Now, obviously, this is not what happened in the case of Silicon Valley Bank.
It didn't happen for obvious reason because they had a target market and the target market was encouraged to bank with this one bank. And again, coming back to another point that you made earlier, what made this so dramatic as well is that this whole era of social media where the investors tell their clients where to invest, and in times of trouble, these same investors tell the depositors when to pull their funds. And this is the essence of the bank run in the case of Silicon Valley Bank. So I think it's very interesting when we look at the business model, the concentration, and then the final bit is this issue of borrowing short, investing long. Here it creates a liquidity issue. So liquidity was also a part of Silicon Valley's problem, because a bank can be undercapitalized and still function, but liquidity is the bloodline of banking. Hence, again, we're going to speak about interest rate risk management and risk management in general, but certainly Silicon Valley Bank, its problems were company specific as against systemic, and this is something for us to speak about as well.
Before we get to that, can I just sort of add a few of my thoughts on this? And I think these are sort of more general lessons, not only for the US, but for sort of financial stability in general, which is that we may live in a world where a single tweet or email to a small number of large depositors can actually spark a bank run these days. So we have this notion of a bank run being associated with people queuing outside the bank. We've seen that as well at some of the Silicon Valley banks, but the root of all of this is a small number of emails or tweets to the large depositors. Now, the large depositors, so we've seen at Silicon Valley Bank, they had a very concentrated depositor base, as Mark explained, who were uninsured. They were quick moving. They were well informed and very rate sensitive in their businesses. And then if you add to that the sort of market moving, the flow of information from the same investment advisors that advise the investors to move money into that bank, to move money out of that bank, you have, you know, all the ingredients for the bank run.
I think we can talk a bit about the depositors, because typically, we have seen interest rate increases over the last year or so, and we anticipate more rate increases will come. But it is not customary for retail depositors to be rate sensitive of such. Institutional depositors are perhaps more rate sensitive than retail depositors. So this bank, by virtue of the clientele that it was serving, it had a clientele that was sensitive to rates. So let's just speak about what happened in this case. So they're getting these short-term deposits. They're probably, for argument's sake, for a very long time, paying zero or nothing on deposits. Interest rates started going up. They're not making loans, so they invest in long-term treasury securities. Deposit starts flowing out. They have to sell some assets. Taking time to sell off assets, interest rates going up, there is an implicit cost. So the losses are mounting on the bank. So the question becomes, in the case of Silicon Valley Bank, and banking in general, what do you do if you're paying more on, you have to pay, you're earning less on your assets and you have to pay more out on your funding? What are you going to do? You're going to try and raise capital. And this is precisely what they tried to do. But by the time they tried doing it, it was probably too late.
Indeed. And another point that I'd like to mention, and I'm sort of slowly moving into the area of regulation or indeed lack thereof, but it touches upon the depositor base, is that existing regulation, as far as I understand it, is not particularly attuned to the risk of bad depositors. i.e. the existence of the depositors that we have seen in the case of the Silicon Valley Bank. And maybe going forward, regulation should be looking more at the composition of depositors than simply the overall amount of insured or uninsured deposits.
But I don't think it's a case in terms of regulation today. I don't think it's a case that these are not issues that are addressed in banking regulation and supervision. I mean, banks are, they have to have good funding plans in place. They have to have good risk management in place. They have to address things like concentration. Certainly from the point of view of the regulators, regulators monitor the growth in deposit base. They monitor the growth in asset base. They monitor the growth in loan basis. So something went amiss in terms of Silicon Valley Bank. From the bank's point of view, I believe that they failed to manage interest rate risk. And in the early days, you would do your interest rate gap analysis. And you would see that obviously there's a, if you are long on the assets and short on the liability, there's going to be significant gap between both. And just a single basis point movement in interest rate will have enormous impact on the bank's capital.
Yeah, I actually agree with you, and in the sense that there was significant, things went significantly wrong in terms of Silicon Valley Bank's business model, and particularly their risk controls. And so in that regard, it's, you know, it's not sort of a next generation bank failure. It's the type of bank failure we've seen for centuries. It just happened to occur in a place at a bank that was deemed to be, you know, more sophisticated and more advanced, whatever you want to call it.
More concentrated.
But you find that the tech industry is as fragile as any other. Any other industry?
Absolutely. And I think the change in terms of the tech industry and even in terms of banking or the wider economy, the change over the last 12 to 18 months is a fact that we have had a return of inflation. So the macroeconomic environment has changed. And there's a fabulous paper from the St. Louis Federal Reserve on interest rate risk management, for example. So for about 10, 15 years, banks knew very little about managing interest rate risk. To combat inflation, all central banks, most central banks are increasing interest rate. So for a bank that started in 1983 to not be managing interest rate risk, that's elementary. That's elementary banking, right? Banking is the business of managing risk, and there are raft of list of risks that are unique and central to successful banking.
And obviously, the Fed has been raising interest rates for about a year now. So it's taken a year for the issues not to materialize. It's not that they weren't apparent, because it was always deemed that the Fed would aggressively, that the Fed would have to aggressively hike interest rates. So that's not a big surprise to anyone. And indeed, there were problems with the bank, as Julian Tett reminded us, I think today or yesterday in the FT, there were balance sheet issues that were identified by other financial institutions before and that weren't dealt with.
I mean, I think I was reading earlier in terms of the bank's Basel III framework disclosure that they identify that obviously if rates continue, this is how they will be affected. Now, to the extent that they themselves identify the road ahead, then I'm flabbergasted as to Why is it the controls or the measures weren't put in place? Is it a case of incompetent management? Again, we deal with the fit and proper requirement in terms of who is responsible for running banks. So, I mean, there are lots of questions to ask about Silicon Valley Bank, but this is a story that I think will continue to unfold over the next couple of days, actually. But Ole, can I just touch on a couple of quick points? Because I guess one question we have to ask is whether or not what we have seen in terms of Silicon Valley Bank, would we say it's systemic? I don't believe it is systemic. However, when we consider the measures taken by the U.S. federal authorities and the U.S. Treasury, I don't know what your thoughts are in terms of how do you read into it? I have my own thoughts, but I'd love to hear yours as well.
Well, I can take a first stab at it. And I am, to be honest, I'm in two minds about this. On the one hand, being a typical economist, on the one hand, we have a crisis management textbook. Now, that being said, if you're in the midst of the crisis, the extent to which you can follow the textbook I'm unclear how much you can follow the textbook page by page when you're faced by such a crisis. So even though we have a textbook, it frequently, generally, always goes out of the window in favor of and what we have instead are these measures. To me, and again, this is nothing new, these measures are usually ad hoc by the central bank and the Ministry of Finance. More often than not, they're sort of arbitrary, and they pick winners and losers and are really confusing. And I think this is also the case what we've seen right now, in the sense that today, Wednesday, the 15th of March, so a week after sort of the first murmurs of the crisis, the situation, touch wood, seems to be stabilizing somewhat. And what we have is a new, a softening of the federal deposit insurance rules. So the depositors were bailed out in full, even though it's only a mid-sized bank. We have a new facility by the Federal Reserve Bank to provide emergency liquidity, which goes against the textbook definition of Bajot in Lombard Street, which is to provide good collateral at a penalty rate. The new facility has no haircut, so the Fed is going to
blanket coverage.
Provides a blanket coverage. So both of these things are not what's in the crisis management textbook.
So, I mean, my view is there are a couple of things. I mean, I think the starting point is perhaps before last week, how many of us knew that there were $9.2 trillion in terms of uninsured deposits, which is probably about 45% of the entire deposits within the U.S. system, that, you know, in the event you have a herd mentality, type of a bank run on other institution, then, you know, that's kind of what we're looking at. So perhaps the thinking is, okay, they have been raising interest rates, so maybe other banks have been going long on other securities, and they are probably facing similar interest rate risk situations. So perhaps to ensure some confidence in the system, the measures by the federal regulators and the U.S. Treasury may be warranted. The question is, are we going against other policies that we have spoken about over the past 10 years, where we have said, for example, that, you know, bail-in as a policy tool is on the table. If you are a large investor, large depositors, how have you looked at the bank where you're placing your money, and what are you prepared to lose in the event of failure? Does this policy that was announced on Monday, does it create a moral hazard? So these are questions that we have to ask. But I suspect the measures were put in place to kind of ease the anxiety in the market.
If I can add to that, I mean, one can debate what the optimal policy response should have been, could have been, and all that. But we can at least concede that US financial authorities have demonstrated they can act quickly and decisively. And this is probably the most important lesson in the risk management textbook, which is not to prevaricate and think about what is optimal and the pros and cons. In many cases, it's speed more than anything else that determines whether the crisis becomes systemic or not. On the issue of the systemic risk, I do find it somewhat amusing, and I mean, I don't want to belittle the fallout from the crisis, that many U.S. mid-sized banks have successfully advocated that they are too small to present a systemic risk to the U.S. financial system, which is why they in turn, they were given a more lenient regulatory regime. But when the crisis hit, their argument for being bailed out was, or were the systemic consequences of Silicon Valley Bank failing. And so, you know, there's a contradiction in terms here, that on the one hand, oh, we don't need the regulation that a Citibank or Bank of America or JP Morgan Chase requires because we're too small. But then when they get into difficulty, it's, oh, you need to worry about the systemic consequences of us failing. So that is,
ironical, isn't it?
That is quite ironical.
Yeah. I thought at the moment you were going to mention that, well, you know, in the last week and a half, it's really three banks that has disappeared. It is Silvergate Bank, it is Silicon Valley Bank, and we learned on Sunday that included in the federal authorities' measures was that they had taken over Signature Bank as well. So let me just walk back with Silvergate Bank and Signature Bank as part of it, because something else happened last year that is relevant to these two other banks, and it's what we have been termed the crypto winter. And again, touching on technology, you know, it is new. We're addressing financial inclusion. We are creating a more inclusive world. But we have two banks that have basically disappeared as a consequence of this new thing. So this is something for us to keep at the back of our minds as well. But
can I just add something? So I have a different take on Signature Bank, which is sort of unashamedly conspiratorial, in the sense that we saw with Silicon Valley Bank that the regulators overdid it in terms of leniency. And as we mentioned, the FDIC limits were breached. And and we have that new Federal Reserve Facility. Now, Signature Bank, it's my understanding today, which of course is only 3 days or 4 days after it was taken over, in principle was sound and solvent, but I think regulators thought that while they were being too lenient on Silicon Valley Bank, they had to, at the same time,
be decisive
and provide a tough lesson on and sort of have a countervailing action against Signature Bank, which was basically unilaterally just closed.
Yeah.
It was simply decided by the New York State regulator of financial services to close the bank. And I think they were just unfortunate to be a scapegoat in the whole thing. But I mean, Mark raises an interesting issue, which is that to some extent, all three banks, I mean, we know that Silvergate definitely sort of in decreasing magnitude, Silvergate absolutely, Signature to a big extent, and Silicon Valley Bank to a smaller extent, were all touching upon the crypto universe. And again, one of the arguments, one of the big arguments of crypto enthusiasts or the crypto industry is that they do not pose a big systemic risk because they are distinct from the traditional financial system. And I think we're now seeing the border that may have at some point existed, the border blurring, and more crypto activities being done by traditional financial service providers. And any volatility in crypto may spill over into
the formal banking system.
The formal banking system.
I think there are a couple of quick points that we should discuss, Ale. Given our membership at the CSUN Center, whether or not there are any implications for Asia and if there are any lessons. I doubt very much that there will be any much spillover into the region. And if I look at the banking system in Asia, it's primarily retail deposits. Some banks, they do invest in government securities, but not to the extent to which we saw in Silicon Valley. So I think from that point of view, I don't see much implication for Asia. There are certain lessons, I think, though.
Yeah, I see a handful of lessons. One is, I think we need to be more aware of the role of deposits. I think for economic growth, for the well-being of the populace, I think deposits will play a major part on the minds of politicians going forward.
Yeah, but to add to that, though, I think is a recognition that in the business of banking, bank management, their responsibility is to safeguard depositors. And that has to be balanced against shareholders' need. And so when you're taking risk is, how do we ensure that when depositors call for their funds, those funds can be accessed by depositors. So we need to have this at the forefront of our mind that in banking, the duty of bank management is to safeguard the deposits that they have taken from the public. And I think that Silicon Valley Bank did that poorly in the sense that, you know, they're banking these high-risk clients and they are taking these deposits, but they weren't managing that risk. So that's one. There are some other implications in terms of when we look at the reforms from the great financial crisis in 2007, 2008, is around bank capital management and how do you ensure that your capital is aligned to the risks that you're taking. And what this means is that if you are taking certain level of risk, it's not just the regulatory capital that becomes relevant. You may have to hold additional capital for those additional risks. And I think this is where the Basel framework, Pillar 2 in particular, comes in handy in terms of what's this bank doing stress testing. And what I would say is that for regulators in our jurisdiction is make sure that we're doing those stress testing. What's Silicon Valley Bank doing in the stress testing? What was the result of those stress tests? Were they aware that they were, you know, they had these significant gaps? And what was the impact on capital, for example? So I think these are things that we have to keep in mind for the CSET stakeholder space as well.
Yeah, I would add to that, constant reminders of the risks to banking. And I'm sort of blanking now because I can only think of the three or the four, but we have interest rate risk, we have liquidity risk, we have duration risk, and then whatever the fourth one is. And my excuse is I'm not a financial stability.
Pricing. But Ollie, you touched on something that we should also go back to as well, is that as we think about this problem, most banking crises are actually caused by credit risk management. We're looking at the situation, we're not dealing with credit risk today. It's not credit risk. I don't believe there's an issue of credit risk today. Right? So this is something for us to keep in mind as well.
I think another point worth keeping in mind is this sort of artificial division, maybe this role of systemically important banks is not helping, or having one regime for the larger banks and a different regime for smaller and mid-sized banks. Maybe there should be more of a harmonization of the rules. I can see that they could make the smaller banks sort of less competitive as opposed to the bigger banks. But, you know, the notion that smaller banks are provide less of a systemic risk, maybe that needs to be rethought. And I say this very with trepidation, and I say this very, very carefully.
If we think about it in terms of size, I mean, you look at what's happening in the U.S., in particular, is Silicon Valley Bank, it never reached that $250 billion threshold to have enhanced oversight by the authorities. And there are a number of banks that are just below that threshold. The reality is that if one of those banks fail and they're interconnected, or if a group of those banks fail, they can actually present a wider risk to the financial system. So yes, there's a reason we have the framework for systemically important banks versus other banks. It's really around how do we allocate regulatory resources? How do we allocate supervisor resources? But at the same time, there are measures in which these banks do get enhanced oversight.
And finally, on my list, at least, is the old perennial financial education. And many jurisdictions require first-time borrowers, for example, to go through an exercise you know, if you take out a mortgage, for example, at a particular interest rate, there is a simulation of what happens to the repayments if interest rates go up a certain percentage point and all of this. So, you know, I'm loath to advise to have this piece of advice for experienced investors, but as we saw with Silicon Valley Bank, you know, maybe the bank can remind the uninsured depositors, send them a letter from time to time, reminding them that a large portion of their deposits is uninsured and at risk and may not be made whole again by the deposit fund. Although now, of course, we're in a situation that once that limit is breached, whether we can backpedal, at least in the US, that is. Think about your own deposit insurance schemes in terms of...
you do blanket coverage, that's one. And we also have to think about the state of public sector funding, because you need that funding to be able to do these things as well.
Indeed. And I mean, this is obviously one of the topics that's being discussed. I don't want to go into too much detail in the US right now, whether this is a bailout or not, with President Biden claiming that it's not a bailout because it's borne by the FDIC and will be borne by the other banks who pay into the FDIC, or whether at some point it will be taken over by US taxpayers.
So, Ole, it's been about a good 30 to 40 minute conversation. We're back to the business of bank failing again. Let's hope that is not something that will become commonplace. And there's more to come.
There is indeed. I'm afraid that you know, we're not doing this for the first time, sadly. There is no next time will be different. We've seen bank failures. Those of us who have gray hair or a little hair have seen quite a few bank failures in our time. And I'm sure there will be others. You know, there's many more things to discuss, many more things we hopefully can return to, or yes, hopefully not return to in another podcast. You know, I mean, off the top of my mind, sort of the reporting on bank runs. What are the sorts of the moral and practical issues involved in terms of social media and the press and all of this? So maybe we should take that up in a future podcast. But just wanted to thank Mark, being an excellent host and co-conspirator here by my side.
Thank you very much, Ali. And please follow us on Twitter and Spotify and LinkedIn, and let us know if you have any questions. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to today's podcast. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so you don't miss any upcoming episodes. If you have a comment or question for our hosts and speakers, email us at podcast@season.org and follow us on Twitter or on our LinkedIn page at Season Center.